Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Sarah McDooling. I am here today with my colleagues Ben Hunter.
Hello.
And John Purcell.
Hi.
That's, you disguised your voice.
Hello, it's me, it's John, I'm here.
And hi, we are, all three of us, delighted to be sitting across from the amazing Dervla McTiernan.
Hello.
Hi.
We got three this time because we...
We were going to fight each other, and then we thought, maybe we can all come in the podcast.
Well, this is a lot more fun. It's like hanging out with friends. The only problem is we have no beer, no wine, and it's a little early in the day.
No, but it's fine. It would be great. It looks like your budget, really, I tell you.
Next podcast, more beer and wine.
And a bar, an evening recording,
I think, is the way to do it.
Yeah, we do have within the Booktopia family, a jazz band.
There you go.
I know, we should just have it playing in the background.
Perfect.
Yeah, intro, outro.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
It would solve our stock music issues.
Yeah, and a bit of, you know, a bit of the comedy sounds. You know, in,
exactly. You know, I like this. This is sounding very good. Yeah. You just have to invite me back when you do get around to that.
Definitely. Well, the budget just keeps growing, you know.
Yeah. But, I mean, we're straying off topic because, you know, Dervla has written a book.
We have to talk about
more than one, in fact.
What?
Would you mind telling people a little bit about your latest book?
Yes, I am going to take a copy down from the shelf to remind myself what I wrote about. I'm very good about talking about the ruin. I'm not quite that good about talking about the scholar yet. I'm getting better at talking about both of those books.
I understand why, because you're so prolific and you're, I think, thinking about book four somewhere in the future.
Yeah.
So, wow. No wonder you don't know what book two is.
This is the problem. My head is very firmly in book three, which I've just delivered to my editors. And so now I'm like, oh, yeah. That was the theme. That was what I was thinking about when I wrote this book. No, The Scholar, it opens with Emma Sweeney. So Emma's a research scientist. She's very, very hardworking, very dedicated to her work. And she is going into the lab late at night one Friday evening, and she stumbles across the body of a young woman who has been the victim of a hit and run, and she's horrifically injured, and Emma is distraught, and she calls her partner, Cormac Riley, who comes running, and Cormac happens to be a police detective. So he ends up taking this case, which is a case he might not otherwise have been assigned. It's the young woman is identified as Carlene Darcy. She's the granddaughter of an incredibly wealthy man who runs this massive multinational, and he's very powerful. He's got a finger in every pie, and he, as it happens, has also sponsored Emma's research. So it's a little bit crossing the line that Cormac takes this case on, but he does for reasons of his own. And then it's only as the investigation progresses that he begins to come across little pieces of evidence that suggest that Emma's stumbling on the body might not be quite as innocent as it seems. So that leaves him wondering, you know, did he do what he should have done in this investigation, or was he closing his eyes to things he didn't want to see? And where does that leave him in his relationship? So that's The Scholar.
It's really not. It's a real test for a relationship.
Just a little smidge of difficulty, yeah.
I do like the way that you've brought in two of those things that compromise us. There's our work relationships, and then the relationships between companies and the private and the public in that. But then there's the private and public within the person and how a family relationship or a friendly relationship with someone can compromise you and drag you into things that aren't that comfortable. It's a very murky ethical area on both counts.
It is, and I think that thing about, you know, in relationships, sometimes we expect our partner to be everything for us, you know, to be all things in one package and to never have doubts and never have questions and just this perfection, the pressure of perfection that we put on our relationships. And, you know, no relationship can survive that for a prolonged period of time, that sort of pressure. So what happens when you stumble? What happens when things aren't as perfect, or when you suddenly have to see your partner in less than rose-tinted light for a period of time? And then how do you survive that? I suppose in the book it's an exaggerated form of that, but that's something we all experience at some level. They just have it in slightly more extreme circumstances.
I loved that part of the book. I particularly loved, and this is again where you have to sort of dance around.
Spoilers.
But I think I can do it, so I'm going to try. Just like...
She's not Olympic at this. She's an amateur.
Maybe I shouldn't say anything. I really enjoyed Emma and Cormac in this book. I particularly
so good.
I particularly enjoyed the exploration, which you just touched upon, that not only sometimes you get tested in a relationship, but sometimes you have to learn that your way of loving and other people's way of loving is not always like the same. But that doesn't mean that they're not equal.
Yes.
Which I love that idea, and I thought it was beautifully portrayed.
Well, that's
well done.
Funny you should say that. It was perfect there. It's funny you should say that, but I'm not a terribly religious person, but I was brought up in a Catholic home, and for various reasons, Kenny and I got married in a Catholic church and then became raving atheists, but that's a long story. But as part of that, you do a marriage course, a Catholic marriage course, where you go and a priest tells you all about how to have a happy marriage, which is an interesting experience. But one of the very helpful things that actually came out of that was they said, you know, just never forget that everybody has a family of origin. You know, you bring to your relationship a whole way of living that comes from family, and it's completely different usually for your partners, no matter how closely culturally you might be. And we are totally different people in how we relate to other human beings. And working that out in our marriage has been, you know, one of the interesting challenges we've had. Thankfully, we've figured it all out. But in the early years, it wasn't always easy. You know, how do you express love? Everybody does it differently. And if it doesn't match your expectations, it can cause conflict where there really shouldn't be any. So even the really simple things can become complicated, I think, even without the kind of pressure you find in a crime novel.
Talking about pressure...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you dodged this pressure a little bit by your book, The Ruin, came out, just a book, came out, took off crazily all around the world.
Awards, awards. But acclaim.
You were already finished with this book. So
yes.
There wasn't that whole, oh, shit, I have to do a second book. Oh, my God, I can't do it. All everyone's watching. But you cheated all that.
I did. I had the loveliest year because I signed my contract.
We'll talk about this
stuff. It was perfect. It was so nice. I signed the contract with HarperCollins October 2016, and then the book, The Ruin, didn't come out until February 2018. So it's that whole year and a bit. I was editing The Ruin and I was writing this book and I was still working my day job. So I was still writing at night when the kids were in bed. And honestly, it was the loveliest time because it was so peaceful, you know, like nobody cared. And there were no expectations, but at the same time, somebody was waiting for the book. So it was the writer's ideal scenario. And I never had that feeling of a blank page where, you know, The Ruin had gone well and I was thinking, oh my God, I don't even know how I wrote that. I sure as hell don't know how to write the next one. I just wrote whatever, and it was lovely. So, yeah, it's good. I recommend having a year and a half before your first book comes out, if you can manage it.
So now that you're writing book three, do you feel more comfortable because you've got two books under the belt and you're feeling, I've done this.
Yeah.
And people are reacting well to it. They must like the way I did it, and I've already done it twice. Surely I can do a third.
I don't know. I feel like I'm trying to learn all the time. So every time I'm coming back to a new book, it's just, you know, trying to learn. And I feel like I'm starting at the beginning again, the kind of a way. I don't know. Do you feel the same way, John?
Yeah, every new book is
different, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just, I felt like when I wrote The Scholar, I thought, this is it. I figured out my process. I'm going to write every book exactly this way. Mm. And then I started trying to do that on the third book and went, oh, no, this is not going to.
Yeah.
I've got to do it some other way this time.
You were a pro on writing the Ruin and The Scholar, but then you're an amateur on writing the next book.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I think that's the best thing, isn't it? Mm. Because
keeps you interested.
Yeah, it keeps you interested and stimulated, and that's where all of that feeling comes from, because it's all coming from that feeling you have inside yourself. And if that ever becomes rote, I think you're going to struggle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the readers would feel that as well.
Yeah, I absolutely think that.
You do feel that with some of these people who do get into a kind of the machine, where there is a great expectation and they need to do the same character again, and they're no longer interested. And you see them wandering off to do other things, a lot of these authors, to I don't know, get them back into writing.
Into feeling it again.
Yeah.
I think the pressure to write exactly the same book, when you have an absolute monster international hit, the pressure to produce the exact same book but a little bit different must be huge.
Yeah, we had a long chat with Marcus Zusak about that.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, because when that book was... he didn't expect the book thief to do what it did.
Yeah.
And then it's done what no book does, you know, and just keeps
going
keeps
and going
doing
and going.
And so, yeah, that page just was right in front of him. and the pressure on him. And he rewrote the book how many times? Like 7 or 8 times.
Yeah.
Like, and from different points of view. It's a big book.
And it's a huge book, yeah.
I have it sitting beside my bed at the moment. It's my next book to read. I haven't read it yet.
Yeah,
oh, you'll enjoy.
So no spoilers.
Yeah, no. So he actually...
Sorry.
Yeah, so he's like one of those gymnasts you see that are sort of like teetering for a moment and then pull it off.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it felt like. Because he landed really well.
Yeah. Oh, good. Excellent. I can't wait to read it.
This is great.
I want to try and work out like the Irish crime thing, because you're living in Australia, you're writing about home. A lot of expats feel that they can write about home from afar.
Yeah.
Because I mean, it's interesting to think about, because you would think that doing all the research and everything like that, but almost the research of being somewhere is overwhelming, and you can kind of whittle it down by the distance. Is that what you're from?
Homesickness makes you draw out all the most romantic and lovely parts of your home. I feel that sometimes, like when you're reading, when you know that the author's not living in their country, but they clearly love their country.
Yeah. I think there are two things. I think when you move away and you live in a country that is very different in terms of its geography and its climate from home, you see the things more clearly that make your that are specific to your country. And you know, if you're writing a description, you don't want to go on and on and on. You want to find those tiny little details that just immediately spark something to life in the reader's head, so they can see the picture. And I think you can identify those details more clearly when you are at distance, and you can see, you know, it's not just the heat or the lack of heat. It's not just the rain. It's the kind of rain, you know, and it's the kind of cloud that isn't everywhere. So you see those things. But I also think it's the distance from family. Much as I adore my family, when you grow up in a culture, in a country, and there are certain expectations, and then you leave, it's very freeing. You know, you can write anything because you're not worried about your mum reading the next day.
It was published over there, you know.
Yeah, I know. I'm in denial about that. Although, actually, on the topic of Catholicism, you know, my dad is actually so quite Catholic, and I was a little bit slightly concerned about him reading the first book, and he read it and he went, you know, Derb, there are things I would disagree with you on, but maybe, you know, we'll agree to disagree. And then he started giving it to all his priest friends. I was like, Dad, you can't give that book to... It's not suitable for Catholic priests. Well, Father Riley said it was great and he loves a good thriller.
I was like, okay, you know, you do you. This is fine.
Oh, that's so good.
The good thing about the Catholics is they're very forgiving.
They're very forgiving, which is great. So I think I've been forgiven, which is wonderful. I'm still allowed to go home anyway, which is
great. We have that
in
common. My uncle's the Bishop of Newcastle.
Ah, okay.
He's got the Catholic
background. Has he read your books?
Yeah.
He knew. We're both very happy about that.
Yeah. You've agreed. You're fine with it. That's the line.
So you're cleaning up book 3, and then you've got book 4 on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
How, in crime fiction, you take this hero and you put him through paces and you challenge them, and then the scholar, you know, Cormac, gets really seriously... professionally and personally challenged, then you kind of just have to repeat these kind of, you put these, it's the mode, you've got to put this character, this strong man, through pressure. What's your approach to that, and how are you going to keep developing?
I do think
surely you cut him some slack in a couple of novels, right?
never slack. I do think that's the real problem with crime fiction in a series form, where you've got one character, because as you say, you really want to put them through their paces. You want something to happen that is going to change them as a person, that's that extreme. Like, maybe the most important thing that's ever going to happen in their lives should be in the novel. But you can't do that in every book, because it ends up, you know, like, didn't they do a thing about Dallas at some point where they look back and they realized all the main characters had like 4 heart attacks, 6 divorces, you know, 3 bouts of cancer. Like, it just gets stupid, you know, after a certain point. So I would like to do is use the other police characters as well. You know, I love Peter Fisher. He's definitely comes more to the fore in the third book. It's very much about his backstory. Cormac is very much part of it, but Peter steps up a bit more. And with the fourth book, at the moment I'm thinking about Carrie, but I haven't discussed it with my editor.
So Cormac in the third book is dealing with the trauma that she caused him in the other 2.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
The only time you see him is with his psychiatrist having a
He's dealing with all the aftermath. And then I don't know where I leave him at currently, where I've left him at the end of book 3. I don't know what I'm going to do with it.
This is brilliant because I noticed, you know, this book, you do spend a lot of time with the other members of this sort of bureau that Cormac's been brought into in Galway. And he sort of where he sits, you don't know who he can trust.
Yeah.
And there's this fantastic tension there. And then you develop some really fantastic people. So to see them explored more.
That's what's so good about it. And also, you're like your characters that are sort of specific to each book are never are also equally as well developed and interesting and compelling, which you don't always find. Like, I feel like the balance is usually weighted. Maybe you have like a crime solver main character who's not got as much going on in their life, and they're more there to facilitate these, you know, crimes that change each book.
Yeah.
Or it's the other way around, and it becomes all about the main character, yeah, and everyone else is like cardboard cutouts.
Yeah.
You've got a perfect balance.
Oh, God, thank you. Very impressed. I don't know. I love crime fiction. I read an awful lot of crime fiction, and I read all kinds of crime fiction, but I do find the most satisfying books are where there's a lot of character development, and I really feel like I get to know them. And the book I absolutely loved this year was Lethal White. I love Robin and Cormoran now. You know, they feel like I know them, and I just want to spend time with them every time. So I would love to try to create that where they start to feel really real, like people you know, like your friends, and you're going to spend time with them. And I really like Peter as a character, and I like the idea of the relationship between Cormac. Cormac started to trust him, certainly in The Scholar. He's got very good reason to, ultimately. And I want him to what happens next then, you know? And then when other challenges come in, the challenge that, how do you react? If you can keep building something that feels real, and then you introduce a circumstance, the story nearly writes itself, you know, mm-hmm. because people react the way you would expect them to. Like, I always think when people say, you know, people ask you about what writers say, you know, characters write the story, and they're saying that doesn't make sense. But actually, if you try to imagine, say you imagine people you know really well. Think about your mom and your aunt, for example. They're sitting in the kitchen at home, and imagine somebody else comes in and says something dramatic or unexpected. You know exactly what your mom's going to say, and you know exactly what your aunt is going to say, and you know what's going to happen next and how it will all develop because you know them so well as people.
Mm.
And the characters become like that. They become like real people, and then you just have to put them in a situation and let it go.
Oh, we mentioned two big books in the last little while, and Lethal White is a whopper.
Yeah.
Is it? I'm always tempted by that kind of landscape to play on. Is there do you look at that and go, oh, it's so nice to take a couple of years off and really investigate these
take
kind of
the
things?
Time.
Yeah, and take the time to develop something that.
Shh, no, we don't want years between books. What are you doing?
Well, she's so prolific. Maybe she can keep the other ones going and then write a bigger, fatter version.
No.
Yeah.
But when you're
in the middle of a book like that, like I saw a guy at a bus stop with Lethal White, and he had it open, and he was right in the middle.
Yeah.
And he was standing at the bus stop, and he looked very comfortable.
Yeah.
But you can see he was not trying to do anything but read that
book. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was it. He was in, and he was absorbed into it.
Yeah, and it's such a luxury as an author to have that sort of a sphere. And her books do get bigger.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they grow as she goes. Yeah, for sure. I just think, I mean, it's a pleasure as a reader to have a book like that you can just fall into and sink into, and it's so lush, you know. I don't know if I write that way naturally. I tend to write short. I'm watching the word count because I know I'm like, well, I have to have at least 100,000, you know. And I think I sketch along the top of the story and then go back and fill in the color afterwards.
Yeah.
So that is a bit of an issue for me. But when I think about taking time, it's to write something completely different that I would be building from the bottom up again, and it would be a world thing. And there's another story I'd love to write that if I had the time.
This is where you get into the fantasy side.
It's a fantasy story.
No, because
exactly.
you sort of teased it out last night,
yeah.
Especially with your favorite books and stuff. You know,
yeah, yeah.
David Eddings.
Yeah, I loved David Eddings when I was a kid. I mean, I've just read those books 5,000 times.
Me too.
Did you really?
Yeah,
oh,
I was
my
a big,
God.
Big fan. That's
hilarious. So, you know, that is percolating in the back of
it. Yeah, it is. And particularly because my little girl is a passionate reader. She just, in the last couple of years, and particularly she discovered the Wings of Fire series, and she has just fallen in love. I mean, it's just, she was always a reader, but now it's completely switched on. And she's 9 and she is inhaling these books. And she wants me to write a book for her because she says, Mum, you know, I'm sure you're a very good writer, but I'm not going to read your books. I hope that's okay. Just think I'm not into the whole merger thing. So,
give that to
so that's it. I'm like, that's fine, Frey, no problem. But we worked over the Christmas. She made a deal with me that we would write together because she writes books and she does little illustrations. It's really cute. So we started writing a story together. So we've got this story that I'm supposed to be writing for her that I just haven't got time to write. But I wrote the first chapter of it, and that just started it. Then in my head, I was like, oh, I want to write this, but I don't have the time right now.
Would you consider like dividing up and putting it under another name?
If I ever did it, I'd have to.
J.K. Rowling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Way.
Yeah. That's that'd be great. Oh, that's a good line. I like that. I'll steal that someday if I ever do it.
So the other one has to be a man. The other name.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Good point. Think about that one.
David Eddingbury.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Whenever this happens, I'm so there for it. Though I am ready.
Really? Yeah. Oh God, HarperCollins will give out to me for even thinking about it. I have to give it some time. I think finish off what I'm doing now.
So last night we were at Literary Bites at HarperCollins, and we got to hear a little bit about your reading history. And you've mentioned your crime writer. And you know, we know Galbraith is one of your big ones. Who else in the world do you sort of,
of crime,
you must have the next one?
God, there are books that I've all, you know, for years and years and years, I've just made. I had to get the next one. The Michael Connelly books, Ian Rankin books, Sophie Hannah in the last few years, very much. Sarah Foster, I'm a big fan. Candice Fox, I think, is a wonderful writer. Who else have I read recently that I really enjoyed? Don Winslow, who I'm not even sure if you could really categorize him as a crime writer exactly, but he's fabulous, and all of his books are like, you know, they just pick you up and it's like a car crash. You can't get off.
Didn't you mention, my brain's just gone,
Tana French?
Yeah, Tana French, yeah.
She was my favorite for a very, very long time. She's something else. I know, she's who I want to be when I grow up. She's just brilliant as a writer. And she does this thing with the Dublin Murder Squad where if you haven't read Tana French novel, she writes crime fiction set in Dublin, but she very much brain hops from book to book. So she has the squad of detectives, and she writes from one character's point of view so utterly and completely, and then moves the next time. And it might be a man in one book and a woman in the next, and the personalities would be totally different. And so the voice of the book changes completely. Like, I've never had come across another writer whose own voice is so subsumed into the voice of the character that she's writing. I don't know how she does it. I think you'd read one and then read another and think they were by different writers, other than the fact that the quality is so consistent. She's just exceptionally good. I really think she's amazing. I'm a little bit of a fan.
Yeah, I've never read any of them.
Oh, they're really good.
I saw social media go nuts when the new book came out.
People
were talking about it. It's very interesting to see. Because now that we're doing this, all the authors that we're connected to on the social media and watching them, and you just see these books go right through the whole community.
Yeah.
And you know what to read next. You go, thank you.
That's the one. That's the one that's rising up to the top.
All the writers are reading this.
Yes.
That's the one after that. Yeah. Have you, with the amount of noise that that the Irish writer Sally Rooney has had this year, and your book, is there an Irish Renaissance on the cusp?
Oh God, I think so, and I think crime writing in Ireland particularly is flying. I mean, Liz Nugent, if you come across Liz Nugent, she's a fabulous writer. She writes really, really dark, dark crime. I mean, she just doesn't compromise at all, not in a brutal sense, but just in the darkness of her characters. And a lot of her protagonists are not very nice people, and it's fascinating work. And she's been hugely successful. And Jane Casey, obviously, who lives in the UK but is Irish, and she has been writing for quite a while, but her crime series is just, she's one of those writers that if you haven't come across her yet, you stumble across her book and you think, oh, fantastic, there's a backlist, I get to read all of these. You know, that happens so rarely. So she's brilliant. Catherine Ryan Howard, whose book The Liar's Girl has just been nominated for an Edgar. I mean, it's just fantastic. So there are so many crime writers. Nate Crowley, there are loads. And of course, literary fiction in Ireland as well is doing very well, but probably always has.
We've got a few of those.
We can claim a few.
What about Australian crime fiction, this new glut of... What do you think has brought that about?
I don't know. I honestly think Jane Harper's The Dry has a lot to do with it. I think it opened people's eyes. I mean, people talk about that cultural cringe thing, which we definitely have in Ireland as well. You know, we wait until people are successful elsewhere and then we say, yay, you're Irish, you know. So I think there's a little bit of that. And then Jane's book, which is so brilliant, was so massively successful. Everybody went, you know what, maybe we are good at this. And then people were more open to Australian crime, because I think the writers were always there, probably. Mm. Just that now people are saying, yeah, you know what, I loved that last one, maybe this would be good too, and they're open to it. And then all of these writers are coming through and just exploding, which is brilliant.
Well, we're so excited for this new book. So excited to know there's two more coming
which is
absolutely brilliant. I mean, your success, we all want to congratulate you on the success of The Ruin, because it was just so brilliant. And over that whole year, you know, to see it just continually there in bestseller lists and being talked about, which is so fantastic.
It's amazing.
And it's the promotion of the first book's crashed into the promotion of the second.
Yeah.
Because it's just hung around.
It has hung around.
And we're in the book industry. We know this doesn't happen very often. So congratulations
Much for all your support as well, Booktopia, because that's all part of it. And HarperCollins have been massively successful. So I just got lucky. I think it was in the right place at the right time.
The right book.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
And you can get hold of The Ruin and The Scholar at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.